Welcome to Febra, a culture podcast about all things infectious disease. We use consult questions to dive into ID clinical reasoning, diagnostics, and antimicrobial management. I'm Sarah Dong, your host and a MedPeds ID doc. Today, we are joined by a team from Sultan Qaboos University in Muscat, Oman. First up, I'll introduce Dr. Raged Al-Abdouani, who is a senior consultant and the head of the Pediatric Intensive Care Unit.
Hi, it's Raged. Thank you very much for having us here today.
Next, we have Dr. Badriya Al-Adwi, who is a medical microbiologist.
Hi, this is Badriya. Thank you for having us today.
And rounding out our team, we have Dr. Zaid Al-Hinai. Zaid serves currently as the head of the Pediatric ID Unit at the Child Health Department.
This is Zaid. Thank you for hosting us.
All right. So as everyone's favorite culture podcast, we always like to start by asking if folks would share a little piece of culture, really just something non-medical that brings you happiness.
So I have a particular knack or interest in hiking, trekking, abseiling. And though I've done a number of international treks like Machu Picchu, Kilimanjaro, Everest Base Camp, but Oman itself offers a lot of really beautiful mountains and caves and a number of very challenging canyons. So sometimes people ask me, like, don't you get enough adrenaline in the PICU? But I always say that adrenaline and these adventures are quite different. And I see it as a way to help in, like, pressing the reset button.
Love it. I don't know. I feel like the extreme hiking and PICU in my mind goes together perfectly.
It does. It balances each other out is how I see it.
So for me, I enjoy going back to my hometown, Nizwa. And a few months ago, I went with my kids and we went to the fort of Nizwa. And it was an amazing feeling. I haven't been there for a very long time. So just walking around with my kids, it was just like, really, I cannot describe the feeling. It felt like I went into a time machine with my kids and went to the past. So it was really, really great.
That's lovely.
Hey, for me, actually, one thing that's really nice about living in the Middle East is the food. There is like this really ancient recipes that have been perfected over like thousands of years. And so I really enjoy learning some of these really old recipes, like once my grandmother would have made. I did learn actually one of the Middle Eastern recipes is the Palestinian recipe called musakhan. Musakhan in Arabic just means something that's warmed up or cooked. This one is really uniquely Palestinian and it's got this unique ingredients, so onions and chicken, not very unique, but then they put sumach, which is a very unique Middle Eastern, like kind of a tangy, a sour spice. And I learned how to make it, and they make it usually with bread. And knowing me, like I always like to put a twist on things. So what I did is I made it in a pie, and that's from my years in America. I put all this chicken and into a pie, and it came out really good. I had a good beginner's luck on that.
You're gonna have to share that with us then, Zaid.
That sounds really good. Well, I think I've told people on the podcast before, but I love cooking and learning about cooking. And I originally wanted to find some way to tie it in where people brought a recipe or a dish that they like to just talk about. But I couldn't find something clever to tie them together. But I still have a special place in my heart for when people bring recipe or food related things as their culture. Well, we have a very interesting case today. I think Riyad is going to introduce us to the patient who's shown up in the hospital.
Yeah, so we started off with the PICU team visiting the emergency department. We went to see a four-year-old boy with sickle cell disease, hemoglobin SS, on hydroxyurea. And he had presented to the emergency department with a five-day history of fever and fatigue, which was just getting worse over the days. He even then started having significant abdominal pain. He vomited a couple of times, and he was looking quite pale to the parents, and even had a yellowish discoloration, as they described. So they took him to the local health center just a day prior to presenting to us. And they did a CBC at that time, which showed that the hemoglobin was 5.4 grams per deciliter. So basically much lower than his baseline, which is about 8 or 9 grams per deciliter. So in the emergency department, the child appeared quite pale. He was jaundiced and drowsy. He was quite tachycardic with heart rates in the 160s, tachypneic and desaturating with SATs of 85% in room air. But with giving him supplemental oxygen, it was above 95%. What was striking is that he was extremely cold to touch. He had poor peripheral pulses and delayed capillary refill of about 5 seconds. But his blood pressure was actually normal high, even 120 over 70. So when we examined his chest, he had a hyperdynamic precordium and he had an ejection systolic murmur at the apex, but good air entry bilaterally with no added sounds. His abdomen was very, very distended, and it revealed also a very tender, big liver, palpable at 15 centimeters below the costal margin, but we couldn't palpate a spleen, which is, you know, what we tend to see in those patients. He was drowsy and irritable, but he didn't have any meningeal signs, and he had no apparent focal neurologic deficits. We examined his ears, his nose, and his throat, and they were unremarkable. Now, in the emergency department, we have access to a blood gas machine, so we did a venous blood gas, which showed that he had severe anemia with a hemoglobin of 2.3, and he had severe lactic metabolic acidosis. So his pH was 7.05, his bicarb was 7 with a base deficit of 15, and his lactate was 22 millimoles per liter. So taking all that into consideration, our impressions that we've got a 4-year-old boy with sickle cell disease and he had shock, and take into consideration that these kids are prone to encapsulated organisms and the fever, you know, we thought along the lines of septic shock and likely a sequestration because of the severe anemia, plus minus a sickle cell crisis. And of course, we were yet to look for evidence of multi-organ dysfunction. So just a little about his past medical history. As I mentioned, he has sickle cell disease, and he had history of previous admissions because of vaso-occlusive crises and needs for blood transfusion. But in the past 1 year, after starting hydroxyurea, the frequency of his admissions were much less. So, Zaid, now with all the above, are there any other additional information that you'd like to know about the patient?
Yeah, so it sounds like the child is in the critical conditions, septic shock, there's some liver involvement. That's a great job to look at a lot of the systems that could be involved. Mm-hmm. We also would like to know a little bit if there's any skin manifestations or joint manifestations in this child. From the ID point of view, we always like to ask about exposure history, very important. So, where does he live? What kind of setting? Was anybody sick that he could have been in contact with? Did he travel anywhere? Do they have any pets? Do they go to any farms? Is there any other animal exposure? Do they consume unpasteurized dairy products or undercooked meat? Is there anybody with tuberculosis potentially? And did he have any insect bites or tick bites or mosquito bites? And did he go swimming anywhere? What is the water source?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that because we did notice at that time that, you know, he had these multiple round hyperpigmented macular rashes of about, I would say, 2 to 3 centimeters in diameter in his upper, but especially in his lower extremities, especially like in the pretibial, the bony prominences areas. But, you know, taking the nature of his dark skin, it was really hard to tell at that time if these were bruises or there were insect, like healing insect bites or maybe a rash of a different etiology. It's not unusual that we see these dark pigmented spots in kids, generally speaking, here with dark skin, but his joint examination was otherwise unremarkable. But in terms of exposures, he does live in a rural area of Oman in a house with a nearby farm. But the parents, upon asking them, had mentioned that they couldn't remember any history of contacts with any animals or cattle or birds. But they did say that he does get the occasional ticks or mosquito bites. Nothing about unpasteurized products that they had taken. And water source, they usually have like drink from bottled water. And there was no history of any recent travel. His immunization was up to date. The thing is, we have a really good immunization program in Oman, and locals tend to really adhere to it, fortunately. In terms of family history, I would say that there wasn't anything that was really remarkable except from another family member who also has sickle cell disease.
And in terms of the immunizations, did he get any of those special immunizations additionally for sickle cell disease, like pneumococcal vaccine?
Yes. So, I mean, you know, again, it's integrated as part of what we have in the health centers. I'm really proud, actually, of our immunization program here. So, yes, he did. So, Zaid, I mean, take into consideration, you know, that impression of the septic shock and all this history into account. What infections do you think would be a likely cause over here?
I mean, this child is coming in very sick. He's coming in from the community. He's been progressively sick over 5 days. You have to think about common things being common. As you mentioned, they can be susceptible to Streptococcus pneumonia and Salmonella in particular with sickle cell disease. So those would be pretty high on the differential as far as septicemia. Additionally, other organisms like Staph aureus, Haemophilus influenza, and Neisseria should be in consideration. Cholecystitis can happen in sickle cell disease, and maybe that can predispose to septicemia and bacteremia. I think although it's looking more like a very acute, maybe bacterial infection, there probably could be a respiratory virus involved, especially some viruses that have tropism to the liver, since the liver here is uniquely addedly involved. So I would think about enteroviruses, adenovirus, influenza, COVID, EBV, maybe some other herpes viruses, although we don't see specific vesicular skin manifestations like for varicella or herpes simplex. I think the hepatitis virus is definitely we think about. At that time that this child presented, the hepatitis A vaccine hadn't yet been in the schedule. It is now. So that was something that we would see from time to time. Never discount something like HIV as being maybe potentially part of this or dengue. And dengue also is mosquito-borne illness. There's a history here of insect bites. And at that time, again, dengue was not an issue in Oman, but now it has become endemic. So now we have to think about it. So those would be, I think, the most common places to start. You always have to keep an open mind, though, for other things potentially, fungal, although I can't think of much there, maybe histoplasmosis or atypical bacteria. Mycoplasma does tend to cause more significant disease and sickle cell disease and other rickettsia, brucella, Q. fever, tularemia, leishmania, mycobacterial TB, parasitic malaria. Malaria would be, I think, an important differential, although we don't have much local transmission at all in Oman. It's usually always associated with travel, but can also be always a consideration. So besides that, maybe after infection, you should think about maybe some autoimmune diseases maybe could this be an unusual presentation of MIC or Kawasaki, but I think those are less likely possibilities.
Right. Yes. Thank you. So, you know, at that point of time in the emergency department, we immediately started management. So, you know, your usual ABCs, oxygen therapy. We gave him a small fluid bolus, not too much because we don't want him to go into heart failure when his hemoglobin is already 2.3. We started him with small aliquots of blood transfusions. He got 3 small aliquots of packed red blood cells. And again, it's small and slow to avoid heart failure. We ended up intubating him with mechanical ventilation, taking into consideration, you know, his shocked state, severe lactic acidosis. His abdomen was quite distended, so, you know, compressing on his lungs. And also, he was in a lot of pain and needed narcotics, so, you know, that would make him even drowsier. So he was intubated. We sent off all the routine labs, as well as, you know, those looking for multi-organ dysfunction, but also those needed for looking for sepsis, inflammatory markers, cultures, blood, urine, tracheal secretions, you know, take the fact that he was initially tachypneic and desaturating. We sent off the respiratory viral panel, mycoplasma PCR, and some serologies, as you'd mentioned, EBV, CMV, HIV, and hepatitis, especially because he was jaundiced and had a tender, large liver. Of course, he was started on broad-spectrum antimicrobials, so cefotaxime, vancomycin, and a dose of amikacin as well. And that's when we started getting the lab results back. His CBC showed, again, confirmed the hemoglobin of 2.3 with reticulocytes percentage of 4%. He had some leukocytosis of 18.6, of which 34% were neutrophils. And he was thrombocytopenic, 73,000. His CRP was quite elevated at almost 350, and his liver transaminases were quite high. His ALT was almost 1,000 units per liter, and AST was 4,200 right off the bat. He had hyperbilirubinemia. Most of it was direct. Some hypoalbuminemia, 37, not too bad. And he had some coagulopathy. His INR was 1.6 with D-dimers of 12.9. But his electrolytes and renal parameters were normal. His chest x-ray was unremarkable, and his abdominal x-ray didn't show any evidence of perforation or intestinal obstruction, you know, take into consideration that significant abdominal pain that he had. So we did a quick bedside echo, and it showed that his ejection fraction was about 50%. So, you know, the lower side of normal. So taking all the above, our findings confirmed that, you know, our initial thought that this is severe anemia, septic shock, and he had what likely looked like hepatic sequestration with some multi-organ dysfunction. And we took him for a quick CT, which actually confirmed the evidence of hepatic sequestration. So we took him to the ICU after that. We worked really hard on him for the first couple of days. And in the next like 24 to 36 hours, you know, by then we had raised his hemoglobin to his baseline. He, after topping him up, we gave him an exchange transfusion as well to make sure his hemoglobin S levels were okay. We made sure he was well volume repleted. He was already on broad spectrum antimicrobials. He was on a good amount of sedatives, analgesics. He was supported with a ventilator. And his blood gas is even normalized. But something was off, because we noticed that at that time, he was still really, really tachycardic, even when he was afebrile. And he was still quite vasoconstricted and really cold to touch. And we even started him on milrinone, which is, as intensive as we call it, an inodilator. It helps with inotropy, with the contraction, but it also helps in vasodilating and, you know, warming them up. We noted that he continued to have high fever, and also his inflammatory markers continued to rise. It even reached to 500. And so although with the other biochemical profile, like his blood gases, the electrolytes were all fine, but his clinical picture wasn't still okay. And something just didn't feel right. So at that point of time, I picked up the phone and I called my friend from the ID team, Zaid. And I said, you know, Zaid, you know, are we missing out on something? Should we be investigating for anything else? Should I be adding another antimicrobial? I can't put my finger on it, but I feel something is not right. So what did you say, Zaid?
Yes, I totally agreed at that point. I remember driving into work that morning and this child was on my mind, and I went first thing to the ICU before any morning meetings to see what is going on with this child, because he's quite critical. He's maintaining his blood pressure, but his extremities are very cold, turning dusky. His laboratory parameters are not really improving, and it's only been 24 hours. But as you said, something really doesn't seem quite right with this child. Hmm. And he's very critical. We're very worried about him. I was relatively new as an ID consultant, and I was really starting to panic a little bit. So at this point, you know, we talked about atypical causes like mycoplasma, rickettsia, things like anaplasmosis and ehrlichiosis, Rocky Mountain spotted fever. These exist in the eastern coast of the United States, in the northeast areas, maybe some other areas as well. but we don't see them so much in Oman. But in my training back in the day, going back to our mentors, Dr. Penelope Dennehy, she taught us that you got to think about these things in such situations, and you got to also think about empiric doxycycline. In Oman, I tried to look around and call for some help. And there are some atypical bacteria and rickettsia-like organisms and more things that can involve the liver as well and not respond to the usual empiric antibiotics like brucellosis, Q fever, possibilities for tularemia, leishmaniasis, maybe syphilis. It would be quite acute, but unusual presentation for that. So I decided to recommend to start empiric doxycycline and also call my good friend, Dr. Bedria from the microbiology lab to help me, because we're really worried about this child and we're not making the progress we like to make. So Dr. Bedria had some good ideas as well.
Yeah, so I actually bumped into Zaid while I was running to a meeting. And he expressed his concern about this child. And lots of investigations were already done, and some were already negative, and some were still pending, but nothing positive so far. So Zaid was particularly concerned about atypical causes, like he just mentioned. So we agreed that we need to do Brucella serology, Q fever serology, and because this is an acute presentation, so we thought of acute Q fever. So we specifically wanted a PCR from whole blood. So serology and PCR, and the PCR we usually send to our reference lab in Oman. Along with Q fever PCR, they can do also rickettsia PCR, so that would be two in the differential list of Zaid to be tested for. And again, from the list of differentials, Zaid was also still concerned about some viruses like herpes simplex, VZV, human herpes virus 6. So PCRs for these were also requested.
Right. So we added the doxycycline. It was on day 2 now, going to day 3 for potential zoonosis. And within 24 hours of initiation, we started seeing an improvement in terms of the fever pattern, the transaminases. Thereafter, the CRP levels started coming down as well, and we were able to start weaning the supportive measures. So by day 4, the fevers had resolved, and we were off inotropes and actually extubated the child, thereafter sending him to the ward. And then during this period of time, we received a call from our very smart microbiologist, Bedria, with some updates from the lab. So, Bedria, would you like to describe them for us?
Yeah, so I actually myself got a phone call as well from the Central Public Health Lab telling us that Coxiella burnetii DNA was detected in that whole blood specimen that we sent. It was around hospital day 2, it was collected. And soon after that, we also had the serology results. So we only do ELISA, we don't have IFA. So Coxiella phase 2 antibodies were positive. IgM was strongly positive and IgG was just above the cutoff. Whereas the phase 1 antibodies were both negative. We repeated PCR after 2 weeks of the child's presentation and it was negative, which was reassuring. We also repeated serology after 2 weeks and then again after 4 weeks. Phase 2 antibodies, both IgM and IgG, remained positive. Phase 1 IgG transiently appeared at the 2-week sample, but then disappeared from the following one, which was again reassuring. So Zaid, would you like to tell us what happened after that?
Yeah, so the first thing we did is we went back. Now the patient's now doing much better after a few days of doxycycline. And then we got this result about the Q fever. So the first, we go back to the family and say, are you sure there was no animal exposure? And they're like, well, he actually likes to spend a lot of time at grandma's house. And she has a bunch of goats in her yard. And he helps spend a lot of time with her, helping her tend to her goats. And some of them had given birth recently and all of that. And like, okay, so that's that's the exposure where this came from. Thankfully, everything was going very well at this point. He had been transferred from the ICU to the ward. The fever resolved for a few days, then started to come back, but alone, and he was otherwise, everything else was getting better. And so we kept extending the doxycycline duration. We did repeat blood cultures. We did the repeat Q fever, Xiella PCR, and nothing came back positive. And so after being on doxycycline for 3 weeks, we decided that maybe this fever was, at this point, maybe a drug fever. We changed to azithromycin, and then the fever resolved. And then after 1 week of azithromycin, we stopped all of the antibiotics. And he did really well after that. He recovered essentially fully. The bilirubin, the albumin, and the ALT, they took about 3 weeks to normalize. The coagulation profile took about 6 weeks to normalize. And he kept following up in the hematology clinic and the sickle cell clinic for, we have more than 2 years of follow-up since then. And he's done very well. So he didn't have any of chronic complications or chronic infection as far as we can tell after that. So it was a happy ending to a very tense situation initially.
Yeah. I mean, what an incredible case. I have not had a case of this, but the best part is hearing that he's doing well. So maybe we can talk about what is Q fever. I'm sure a lot of us need refreshers and we don't see it that often. How does it present? What should we look for? Zaid, maybe you can tell us about some more info about Q fever.
Right. So Q fever, it has this funny name that starts with the letter Q, and that apparently comes from query. So the initial cases were not very clear as far as the etiology. And so they used to call them query fever, and then it became eventually Q fever. And then later on, the bacteria was discovered, which is the Coxiella burnetii. It's named after the people who discovered it. It's an intracellular bacteria. It's a zoonosis. The main reservoir are the different animals can be the reservoir, but for as far as human infection, the most significant would be farm animals. So cattle, sheep, goats, they tend to get infected with this organism a lot. Sometimes there can be also outbreaks that can cause kind of abortion outbreaks. So like in a farm, there can be a lot of abortions all of a sudden among the animals, and that could be related to the Coxiella. So humans who are in close contact with farm animals mostly are the highest risk usually to get infected. The distribution is quite worldwide. So in the U.S., there are dozens, sometimes over 100 cases in a year. Australia is another country where there's usually a lot of reports. In the Middle East, we also have a lot of Q fever. And there's a lot of communities and farmers and people who spend a lot of time with the sheep and other farm animals. In Oman, our country specifically, the first case was diagnosed officially in the year 2000. So our healthcare system was a little bit late to develop, more like in the 1970s and 80s. And so some of these diseases were not recognized by laboratory confirmation until maybe more recently. At that time, they did a seroprevalence study, and they found about 10% of adults were seropositive at that time in our country. So it's not that uncommon. The fever itself, the symptomatic infection, is seen a lot more in adults than in children. So children are only about 5% of all of the cases. So it tends to be maybe more asymptomatic and self-limited when occurring in children. The symptoms usually are a non-specific flu-like illness with fevers and maybe headaches and body aches. It can be sometimes presenting as fever of unknown origin. It has a tropism for the lungs and for the liver. So you can see atypical pneumonia, you can see hepatitis. Sometimes, less commonly, it should be associated with encephalitis or pericarditis. In children, the prognosis is usually good, but there are reports of severe cases, including deaths. One of the severe manifestations is acute fulminant hepatitis, and that's been described in children and in adults. There is also, in about 1 to 5% of patients, there's progression to chronic infection. And that usually manifests with osteomyelitis, which can be multifocal, and also endocarditis. And endocarditis usually here happens in the setting of patients who already have underlying heart disease, like valvular heart disease.
Right. So Badria Azid was just mentioning that it's through reservoirs of farm animals, but what is the actual mode of transmission for acute fever?
So transmission to humans occurs mainly through the inhalation of contaminated aerosols from infected animals or infected environments. Coxiella is able to survive in the environment for a very long time. So even non-direct exposure to animals can still cause acute fever. And as Zaid mentioned, birth byproducts like placenta and amniotic fluid, these particularly have very high numbers of bacteria. And so exposure to these is very high risk, like this child had. So he was basically there at the wrong time. So he was there in an environment where goats gave birth recently. And so I think that's probably the way he got it, unfortunately. There are some other less common modes of transmission, but these are less common, and some of them are actually rare and some are not even proven. And these include percutaneous exposure, like, for example, through cuts in the skin while dealing with animal products. It could also be through ingestion of, for example, unpasteurized milk. And possibly it could be tick-borne, possibly. And there has been some rare instances of person-to-person transmission, like, for example, vertical transmission, sexual, through transfusion and through transplant.
And, you know, we talked a little bit about the testing that was sent for this patient, but maybe, Badria, if you could summarize again for us, how do we think about screening and confirming this diagnosis, particularly since it's so uncommon?
Right. So to start with, a disclaimer, I'm not an expert in Q fever. Maybe we should have invited somebody from Australia to go through this. The CDC has actually published a very useful document in 2013. And I always go back to that document. It basically describes the diagnosis and the management of Q fever. And it also provides criteria for labeling a case as confirmed or as probable. So in general, when it comes to testing for Q fever, testing basically aims to either detect the organism itself, and that would be mostly by PCR. But there are some other methods, like, for example, culture, which is generally not recommended as it is difficult and it has, you know, exposure risk. And there's also immunohistochemistry. So this allows us to detect the organism. The other way is to detect antibodies against the organism. So that would be using serology. And the best method would be by indirect immunofluorescence assay, because that actually provides titers. And titers are very important in the diagnosis of Q fever. Because, for example, a confirmed acute case of Q fever requires either the detection of Coxiella in a clinical sample or the demonstration of a fourfold rise in phase 2 IgG titers between paired sera that are collected 3 to 6 weeks apart. For chronic Q fever, again, laboratory confirmation requires either the detection of the organism in a clinical sample or the demonstration of antibodies, but this time against phase 1 antigens. That goes with chronic Q fever. And the titers that are diagnostic are more than or equal to 800. Or if using doubling dilutions, it will be 1024. So in our lab, as I have mentioned earlier, we use ELISA, which does not provide titers. However, fortunately, because we managed to catch the organism on time and we managed to get a positive PCR result, this was a confirmed titer by definition.
Yeah. And, you know, thinking about the other features about this case that are a bit unique is this patient's history of sickle cell disease. And I thought maybe I'd ask about this concept of acute sickle hepatopathy and what that means.
Right. So this case was very fascinating because of the presence of the sickle cell disease, the severe liver involvement, and then the Q fever. So we really looked at the literature to see what is there about sickle cell disease and Q fever? Actually, we couldn't find any case of Q fever reported in the setting of sickle cell disease itself. So it's a very fascinating case, this one, showing like the intersection of these two diseases. But acute sickle hepatopathies, this is an entity that's quite known in patients with sickle cell disease. Some studies estimate that up to 10% of patients with vaso-occlusive crisis can have hepatopathy or liver involvement. They're quite dangerous, so there can be the mortality in some studies can be 11 to 14% in adults, probably lower in children, thankfully. There are different types of acute sickle hepatopathy. So the first one is thought to be the hepatic crisis, which is basically a vaso-occlusive crisis involving the liver. And there would be some tender hepatomegaly, elevated liver enzymes, fever, and mild jaundice, but it's not a very severe presentation. But the next is what we started to see in our patient is hepatic sequestration. And here there's sequestration within the sinusoids of the liver. And there you get very massive hepatomegaly. It's very tender and you get severe anemia and you start to see direct hyperbilirubinemia, but the liver transaminases are not yet severely elevated. Maybe the most severe form, probably progressing from there, is intrahepatic cholestasis, where then you have all of the previous findings plus the marked elevation of transamination and progressive liver failure, which is what we started to, which we're seeing in our patient. And so what we think happened here is that the Coxiella having the hepatic tropism probably caused this liver inflammation, and that triggered maybe the more sickling of the red blood cells, the sinusoids, leading to hepatic sequestration, which then leads to maybe sinusoidal dilatation, compression of the biliary tree, and intrahepatic cholestasis. That's our hypothesis of the process. These acute sickle hepatopathies are well described with a lot of other infectious agents, especially those that affect the liver, like hepatitis viruses and Epstein-Barr virus, and even autoimmune disease, they can happen. But with Q fever, this seems to be, for us, as far as we could tell, this was the first report. We also looked at maybe other rickettsia. Well, Q fever is not exactly a rickettsial disease. It's a category of its own, but it's related. They're kind of like cousins with the rickettsia and Legionella, if you could say. So we did find there was some cases of anaplasmosis. There's one case of anaplasmosis, hemoglobin SC, that was quite severe, presented multi-organ failure. But besides that, I suppose that there could be some similar presentations with rickettsial disease or maybe anaplasmosis or any hepatotrophic, basically bacteria or infectious agent could present with acute sickle hepatopathy. So that was a very unique and fascinating aspect to this case. And we could be at least happy that the child had a very good recovery, although we were really worried about him at the time he presented.
Yeah. Well, I always like to wrap up by opening it up just to ask if you have any additional comments or lessons that you've learned. You've been really great at pointing out things that stood out to you as we went, but anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I mean, I would say is that, whenever the clinical course doesn't go as expected, sometimes you get this gut feeling, even if you cannot put your finger on it. Think again, go back to the beginning, what did we miss? And don't hesitate to call up a friend and ask for help, different specialties, just putting their heads together and trying to come up with a solution.
From my side, I have to say that I really admired Zaid's perseverance. And he went back and actually asked again about the exposure history, even though he got a no the first time. But he went again and he asked again. So I really admired that. And another thing I would add is sometimes you really have to seize the moment, like they say, and catch the organisms at the right time. So I'm really glad that we got that first sample for Coxiella PCR, because it soon disappears after that. And it did actually disappear after 2 weeks. And since we don't have IFA, our ELISA wouldn't have been diagnostic, but we caught it at the right time. So I'm glad we did that.
From my point of view, so one thing that was interesting about this case, why did we send the Q fever PCR? And I was like running around the hospital worried about this patient, and different people would offer their ideas as to what's going on. And one of the residents, he stood in front of me and said, "Have you thought about Q fever?" And why are you thinking about Q fever? And apparently he had seen some cases in adults, like in adult in medicine rotations. And that got me like reading about it. And I asked Petria about it, and she's like, "Yeah, we can send a PCR." Because I never seen a case before. It's not very common in children. And we just read about it in textbooks, like it's very rare to see the actual symptomatic case in a child. And so thankfully, I had the humility to listen to the resident and go with that. And, you know, so I think that's very important to listen to people, even as we progress in our career, to always listen to everyone and take their ideas mm-hmm. very seriously. And I think another important point here is the empiric doxycycline. Sometimes when things are looking unusual, atypical, I think it saved this child's life. And in fact, if anything, I would say maybe we start a little bit late on the second day. Maybe we could have even started earlier with the empiric doxycycline. So that's, I think, another important lesson here. So, yeah, and thank God for microbiologists, right?
Thanks so much to our guests today for joining Febrile. Don't forget to check out the website, febrilepodcast.com, where we post the consult notes, which are written supplements to the episodes with links to references, our library of ID infographics, and a link to our merch store. Febrile is produced with support from the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Please reach out if you have any suggestions for future shows or want to be more involved with Febrile. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, and I'll see you next time.